Hello, heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. First of all, I just want to thank everyone who contributed to the one-shot Patreon drive. We hit our funding goal, and that means that Inspector Jackie and Feng Shui will return for a third series. Part one of that series is already up on the Secret Archive now, so if you want in on that, you can go to patreon.com/oneshotpodcast. My guest today is game designer Jay Treat, whose work spans the digital, card-based, board-based, role-playing, live-action, and more. I was blown away by Jay's tragic three-player LARP, Damned Love, about a witch, her demon, and her lover, when I first encountered it a few years ago. And you've probably heard me praising his improvised Starship Bridge Simulator Strange Gravity quite a bit over the last little while. I appreciate Jay's quiet and thoughtful approach not only to his games, but to the communities of design and play to which he belongs. So let's see if I can bring him out of his shell a little bit. Origins. Did you have a good origins?
I did have a good origins. It was exhausting, but very productive and fun too.
Was that like your first time like demoing? I mean, which is different than like playtesting or just like incidentally running, but like specifically kind of almost kind of pitching a game? Because you were demoing Merchant of Araby, right?
Yeah. I did demoing for Stronghold Games a few years ago, but this was the first time demoing my own game, and that was a very gratifying experience. Demoing is very very exhausting because you're kind of on all the time, for hours on end. But yeah, demoing my game was really a pleasant experience because you know half the players after the game were like, "How much is this?" and seeing that immediate reaction and being like, "You can buy it 5 feet that way." feels really good.
Oh, that does sound really satisfying. So, like, people were into it? It went well? It was good? Was anyone rude to you? Was it ever, like, not satisfying? People were like, "This game sucks."
Definitely no one was intentionally rude. you know, there were one or two tables where I could tell that they were not into it. Mm. And we're ready to go when it was done. But yeah, no one was actively rude.
That's really nice. People can be grumpy sometimes. Yeah. I'm glad that they were not grumpy to you.
Me too.
So you, Jay Treat, are like an interdisciplinary friggin' game designer. Like Strange Gravity and Damned Love are LARPs. You know, Merchant of Araby is this board card game. You've worked on digital games as well. Twisted and Prisoner's Delight are just, like, not anything else. They're just games.
They're just
you have an entire separate Twitter feed for Magic the Gathering tweets, which I could not parse. It was like, I tried my best to understand what was happening. I asked people. They could not explain it to me. So I think of all of these as being, like, so different. But for you, like, what are the design principles or the practices that apply across all of these different styles?
So elegance in the design is certainly one guiding thing, and then I always have some goal that I'm going for. Not every game that I've made is about positive player interaction, about finding ways to compete with opponents in a more friendly way, but that is something that I try whenever possible to put into a game. I mean, that was essentially the backbone, the soul of Merchants of Araby is and Cahoots, which is a card game that will be coming out later this year from Mayday Games. That I want people to see that even when you're trying to do the best for you, sometimes the best way to do that isn't to go out of your way to hurt other people. Sometimes the best way to help yourself is to actually collaborate with other people, help other people, and kind of benefit mutually.
So that's like a guiding principle for you. Because I know that you, like, just from hearing you and like reading your thoughts on game design, you're often very heavily leaning away from combat and violence in your games and always trying to think, like, how can we model other things?
Yes. Yeah. Well, one thing is that we've done violence, right? We've covered that.
Yeah, we got that.
There are very few new takes on combat that can be done in games. So it's not even that it's, you know, wrong or bad in games. It's just that it's been done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many other things that haven't been modeled or haven't been modeled enough. There's massive amounts of game design space that remain to be explored. That said, I'm working on a combat game right now.
What? Really? What is it?
So it's called Soulborg, and the premise is that the apocalypse has come and wiped out the majority of humanity, but left kind of all the stuff behind. But we've also burned up all our fuels. But with all this awful death, the veil between reality and the afterworld has also weakened, and so we are now using necromancy to summon the spirits of the dead to possess these old vehicles, wrecks, objects, and give them power and life, and then we try to kill each other with them.
Whoa!
So it involves overlaying transparent spirit cards on top of opaque vessel cards, and then the combination of symbols on those two cards is unique. And tells you what that particular Soulborg is.
Wow, that's really intense and unique. You know, you seem like someone who always has like a billion game ideas on the go at any time, and you're constantly just tossing off like, what if a game like this? And you don't always seem particularly attached to all of those ideas. How do you know when an idea is worth pursuing?
So I could say that. If I can really imagine it being something both compelling and unique, but honestly, the answer is just, you know, what excites me? What in my gut am I excited to work on? What do I think will be fun to make a prototype and play test? Those are the ideas that I pursue.
How do you know when something's worth, like, setting gently aside? How do you avoid getting too attached?
I do that a lot too, both with ideas and prototypes that I've built. You know, if it's an idea where I'm like, yeah, that sounds clever or that sounds neat, but I don't. If it's not so engaging to me just at that level that I'm already thinking about, okay, what would this look like? What would it feel like? What are the ramifications of this or that? What kind of mechanisms would I use to motivate the players? So if I'm not drawn into the idea, then it's going to be a lot of work to complete. It's going to be every step of the process is going to be like, okay, now I have to figure out this thing. And what is that? And I'm going to be having to do all of the work for it. Whereas if I'm inspired, I'm just, you know, chasing my thoughts and writing down as much as I can.
Right. You know, considering that you work in a lot of different mediums, how do you know, or do you always think of in advance, like, what kind of form that an idea is going to take? And have you ever had an idea that was like, oh yeah, this is definitely a LARP, and then you test it and you're like, no, it's a card game, whoops?
The vast majority of the time, I know what format it's going to take. But there have been a couple times where I'm like, all right, maybe this is LARP, maybe it's an RPG, and it surprises me which way it goes. Yeah, and certainly there have been redesigns that have vastly changed a game, you know, from a board game to a card game. In certain semantics, that's meaningless. But, you know, a game that features things moving around on a board versus something that doesn't, you know, that's not, well, I was going to say that's not as hard a transition as between a LARP and RPG, but that also is kind of a thin veil depending on your components, so.
You've said to me that you often rely very heavily on cards in all of your designs. Why do you think that is?
Cards let you put a story on a little page. They let you put, you know, a little short story on a page that is a third the size of a 8.5 by 11 sheet. And the way that you write it will affect people. You know, that doesn't mean that you're going to make somebody play, somebody cry while they play a card game, but every one of those cards is an opportunity to really help players visualize how the plot of their game is developing. And it's in some ways it can be a crutch because you can say, okay, well, if you don't look at the flavor of the cards and you just look at, okay, these are people passing pieces of cardboard back and forth and rolling dice, sometimes you might, from that perspective, you might see a game that really isn't that narratively interesting. It doesn't have the climax. It doesn't have all these twists and turns that you might want it to. And you do want that stuff in your game. But if you're using cards, at the very least, there's going to be an in-world story that is unfolding that is either interesting or funny. Right, because so one of the really neat things about Solborg is that you're combining kind of ridiculous things. One of the spirits that you can summon is Marie Curie, and one of the vehicles that you can use is an old ice cream truck. And sometimes you've got Marie Curie in an old ice cream truck. I've got Charlie Sheen in an El Camino, and sometimes it's something big and badass like a dragon in a mech walker. But you know, those just, even just pairing those two cards, just the two names going together tells a story that makes players either laugh or smile or you know, have an interesting thought of what would that be like. Cards are very powerful at drawing the imagination.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of cards, I want to ask you so much stuff about Strange Gravity, which has kind of a neat card-based setup for putting together characters. Strange Gravity is something that I've like talked about a bunch, and I like tweet about it a lot. I recommend it a lot. So like, first of all, give my listeners the pitch for Strange Gravity.
Strange Gravity is a live action role-playing experience where you get to be the crew of a starship bridge. And the kind of the mechanical hook is that instead of there being a single facilitator, all narrative authority is divided between the players according to their character's role on the ship. So the kind of most archetypal example is if you're playing the soldier, the weapons officer, then you decide how all combat, how all physical conflict, you know, what happens, how it resolves, that's all in your wheelhouse. You decide that. If you're the pilot, you decide where the ship ends up. If you're the engineer, you say what goes wrong with the ship and how we have to work together to fix it. If you're the doctor, you tell us what's wrong with us. And so all the players are working together, sharing the narrative authority to push the story forward. I guess my favorite character, my favorite role is the counselor. Because yes, the counselor has the narrative authority to assign relationships. And that is so fraught with dramatic opportunity. You know, halfway through the third scene, you just inform that the captain and the first mate that you know, they're got some sexual tension that they're trying to work through. You know, and that is just super fun.
It is really, really fun, especially to make those kinds of declarations like mid scene, to just be like, oh yeah, you two hate each other. You were like rivals at the academy. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah. And players always enjoy that too. Yeah. Right. So it's a very different take on role playing, because normally the default understanding in a tabletop RPG or LARPs that follow that model is that I have complete narrative authority over my character and nothing else, and the GM has authority over everything but our characters. And because we've split that narrative authority differently, you know, I'm the one that gets to tell you what your relationships are, and you're the one that gets to tell me what my vulnerabilities are, and it's actually really, it's freeing in some ways to have somebody else get to tell you what your character is, and it's a really fun challenge to get to play with that.
So Strange Gravity is meant to kind of elicit Star Trek-like stories, but those could be many, many different kinds of stories. Sorry, I can just picture your face right now. You're like, yeah. Because there really is like a huge, huge variation in tone, which is a cool bunch of possibilities. And it's really interesting to see that kind of breadth. But it also presents the challenge of like everyone has to agree on tone. And that can like be surprisingly difficult and be like a stumbling block for people. And we don't really have a lot of practices for calibrating, establishing, and checking in about tone specifically. I feel like we have more tools for calibrating content than tone. So like what are your ways or what are your recommended ways for people who are co-creating a story to stick to or agree upon tone in a game?
So that is very much something that I'm actively thinking about right now. In the box that you buy right now, the game asks you all to discuss and agree on tone before the game starts, and it also makes sure that there's a commercial break halfway through where people can, you know, hit the restroom if they need to, but also to recalibrate. And that break has been really important. It's a really good chance for players to say, hey, this aspect is getting a little silly, or this is getting a little dark, or even just, you know, talking about where they want to see the plot go. I've been really happy with that break. That said, I believe that there's still a lot more opportunity for the game to help players agree on tone. And I am right now devising playtesting plans to try to work out a better solution. I want to replace some of the more silly improv workshops at the beginning with more character-focused tone-setting workshops. And I'm hoping that that will help.
Interesting. So what would a workshop like that look like?
So there are a couple of goals. One of them is kind of to focus on a character and figure out what that character is. And in that mode, we would all, so the player whose character is in question, everyone else would be in character, just kind of dropping in and establishing, you know, mini scenes where it's all about, okay, what is it that you want to establish about your character? If you want to establish that your character is this lovable dope, then we're just going to spitball a bunch of, you know, 5 to 30 second scenes in which the audience gets to see characters interacting with your character that supports the concept of lovable dope. You know, if you want to be the sexy badass, then we're going to improvise just real quick mini interactions where the audience sees your character being sexy and badass. I'm hoping that will help players get into character. So because all of that is happening kind of before the game proper as a workshop, I'm hoping that will also give players an early chance to experiment with the tone that they've agreed on, see where the group is actually zeitgeisting toward, and then correct on that before the game even starts. And then the other purpose of that, I'm hoping, is for some of the harder roles, for all of the roles, to practice their narrative authority in a more focused way. Some of the warm-ups that we did kind of hinted towards some of the characters. But for example, the first mate has a very important role in starting and stopping every scene. And so that player, even though that player doesn't say what the scenes are, just by deciding who's going to be in the next scene and where it is, they have a lot of influence, and some of the game's quality is dependent on that player. And so I want to give that player as much practice and as much feedback and support to do that as possible.
Cool. So are we going to see like new editions of Strange Gravity, new versions?
Yes. Yeah. So once that stuff is done, I'm going to update what is currently available from DriveThruRPG with that content, and I'm also going to make the new content available as a standalone for anyone who already got the original version.
Oh, cool. Interesting.
Assuming it works, which yeah, I think it will.
We'll see. Are you, like, workshopping those workshops?
I I haven't done any of them yet, but I'm going to, yes.
Cool, interesting. Are we going to see, like, the Strange Gravity setup where you have roles and there's that distributed sort of GM-ish role in other settings? Like, other than space adventure?
Hmm. I don't know. I can tell you that that idea originally came from a game that I improvised on a trip to Gen Con a couple years ago.
Really?
Which I submitted to the Three Forged Game Design Challenge as an RPG. And I was excited when one of my, at the time, anonymous collaborators turned it into a LARP.
Hmm.
But my one test of that LARP was, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't like, oh, I need to go publish this. So that was Psychic Detective Agency. And so the way that Narrative Authority was distributed there was that there are three psychics who are helping the police to, or some government authority, to uncover a murder or some other serious crime. And one of those psychics can see the past, and one of them can see the future, and one of them can see and hear the present. So what people are thinking right now, what, you know, all this stuff. And so those three players split. So that's what their characters can do. And then those players have that narrative authority. So if the psychic who sees the past announces that, you know, something happened to my character 20 years ago, that's now true. And so forth. The really tricky one being, well, okay, so the fun one is the psychic who sees what's happening right now, because they can effectively read minds and things like that. And when they use their narrative authority to do that, they can literally tell me what my character is thinking right now, and they're telling the whole room what my character is thinking right now. And suddenly my character was thinking that just mm-hmm. then, and everybody knows it, which is real interesting.
Yeah.
And then the tricky one is the psychic who sees the future, because right, they say something is going to happen, and now we all have to figure out how to make that true, how to make mm-hmm. that happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that I will use that distributed narrative authority somewhere else. It's also possible that I feel like I've done it with Strange Gravity, and that I'll be happy if somebody else uses that in something else.
Okay, cool. Open for hacking. Got it. You know, I read an interview with you on Bellwether Games where you said something that resonated with me, which was a completed game that is a failure is so much more valuable than an incomplete game that might be brilliant. How do you fight perfectionism and just make the game exist already?
Yeah, that is real tricky. Having too many ideas helps. So yeah, when I'm itching to start a new game idea, I can't do that until I stop working on you know, the current thing or one of my current things. And there are only two ways to do that, and that's either to drop the ball or to get it done.
Mm.
If the game's not good right now, then I will be happy to drop the ball and maybe pick it up later. But if I still feel like that game's a good game, then I owe it to the game to finish it. And so, yeah, you never want to release something that isn't good, that isn't done, right?
Right.
But yeah, it doesn't help anyone to just keep redotting your I's and recrossing your T's. Once you've got it so that it's, you know, good, like it's a really just fun game for everyone 95% of the time, you just stop. You're wasting your time. Your time is better spent, you know, working on that next game that is currently only fun 25% of the time. And you know.
Thank you. That's very encouraging. I like that. Well, you've been at this game design gig for quite a long time, many, many years. How would you say that your approach or your process has changed over time?
Certainly, when I started making games, I was more interested in the system. I was really just having fun finding elegant simulations or clever mechanisms.
Mm.
And that can be a trap. It's really, really easy to make a clever system, an elegant mechanism, whatever, that is zero fun. Because I think that's the big realization for me, and that's why there are a number of very good games out there, very popular games out there that I don't enjoy at all, because they're not social. They're not about what the other players do. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's where the fun of the game is. And so I don't think about those systems very much. I think about the player experience. I think about how players are going to interact. I think about where the fun is going to be. The ironic thing being that now, even though I had all that practice just designing systems and mechanisms, now when I go back and I'm saying, okay, I know what the experience needs to be, I know what the interactions are going to be, what am I going to put in the middle that the players actually do? What's the mechanism that makes this work? And I still have to think about that.
Can you tell us about A Pirate's Life? Because I'm very excited about this game, and I want to know how it's going.
Pirate's Life, the idea that inspired me to build that game is that I wanted to role play an elective family, and I really liked the idea of a group of people who are outcasts, partially by their own volition and partially because they're too weird for society, and who choose to live together and kind of shun society's norms and kind of guide and protect each other and you know, not necessarily even like a nuclear family, because, you know, none of them are blood. And so pirates really fit that bill, or at least they can if you take a little bit of creative license to the concept.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that hard to imagine 10 people who didn't quite fit into society or running from society, who just decide to get on a ship and hang out with some strangers and find another life. And because they're not particularly welcome back home, they have to sail around and find new friends and protect each other. And that felt like something that we needed right now. That game is very much still early in development. I have playtested two versions of it, once each, and the first one was way off the mark. It was fun, but it wasn't touching in any way. And the second one also needs some fairly serious refactoring. But I definitely haven't given up on the idea. I just need to. The main thing is that I had, so the mechanism that I'm currently using is that each player has a card for each other character, and that card describes some type of interaction that those two characters are going to have. And so players just build scenes playing cards whenever they see that they fit. And the power of that is that I can guarantee both very relevant character development, very relevant relationship interactions, and some really fun pirate tropes, because I can just put those on the cards that I know are going to get played, and I know that's going to happen. And I'm pretty happy with that stuff. But what we found in the last test is that there was no cohesiveness to the story. It's really just a bunch of snapshots that are completely unrelated. And in order to get players to really feel the story, there needs to be an actual like beginning, middle, and end, and a development. So I need to work on that.
Interesting. You make pirating sound so wholesome.
In that particular perspective. Yes.
No, I dig it. I dig the, like, imagination pirates. Although, I don't know. Like, I'm not saying pirates are bad. I don't know. I don't know enough about
real
pirates.
I mean, so if I really wanted to go dark, right, I could I could still make a game, because pirates are criminals, right? Real live pirates steal from people, they hurt people, they scare people, and sometimes they kill people. And that's real bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Those pirates are also people, though. They're also going through some real tough times, or they wouldn't be pirates. And they're doing it together, and you know that they're having some serious emotions doing that. That's not necessarily the story I want to tell, but it's a story that somebody could tell and could be really affecting.
Yeah, I could get into a cool story about criminalization and togetherness. if this is like an off-the-wall question, but I have it here for some reason. I thought of it. If you had like unlimited resources and you could just, you didn't have to worry about like money or anything, and you could just make a LARP, what would that LARP look like?
Money might not be the problem, but the answer to that is a haunted house LARP. I had this idea. I posted it maybe a year ago. The idea would be to buy a mansion, you know, some creepy old weird mansion, and hire, you know, get some special effects people in there to rig up cool things in every room, kind of like you would do for, you know, the haunted houses that people tend to pay for today. But then the difference would be, instead of bringing in different people, you know, every minute, every 5 minutes, like a cattle car like they do, you would instead sell 4-hour segments, and you would get a more atmospheric horror experience where the players play characters. You would come in costume, or you would be given a costume on site. There would be paid LARPers, professional LARPers, who would be the staff of the hotel, the NPCs, and every, you know, and it would be groups of, you know, 4 to 12, depending on the setup, going through this house as characters in the story, you know, experiencing a really creepy horror, as opposed to, you know, just jump scares. I think that would be a really cool thing. I think it could even be a commercial success if you could get it started, which I don't see how you could. I'm just not so ambitious, I wouldn't. That kind of project would take my sole focus for years, and I can't focus like that. I have to do other games.
And there's more to that, to a project like that, than design, right? Like, you could design it, but the amount of just like organizing and coordinating and, you know, HR that would go into it would be this totally different thing, sourcing and, yeah.
Yeah, you'd be running a business.
Yeah, a lot of overhead in the haunted house business. See, I'm like way too easily frightened. I don't enjoy being frightened to ever do like a haunted house. But if it was a haunted house LARP, I might be slightly tempted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
That's exciting. So regardless of like pie in the sky possibility projects, what are you working on right now that you're like really stoked about?
So I mentioned Solborg is the card game with the transparent cards going over the other cards and creating unique and hilarious combinations. I'm pretty excited about that. That idea is really only 3, maybe 4 weeks old, and but I iterated on it so fast that there's already at least one publisher looking at it. And
cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about that one. Like I said, Cahoots is a trick-taking card game that will be hitting Kickstarter from Mayday in the fall. Pretty excited to see that. I'm happy with the work that they've done.
Did Cahoots have like a digital version at some point, or am I thinking
it
something else?
It does. Yeah, you can go onto the iOS App Store and find Cahoots with an. So the app has an exclamation mark. the actual game will not. Yeah, that is a trick-taking card game where your partner, who you partner with, is your choice at each turn. And that's kind of based on what cards you have and how the trick goes. You might start trying to partner with me as the trick begins and decide to jump ship and partner with Sean by the end. My most undeveloped game that I've actually started is Trailblazer. That is a map drawing game where players are competitively collaborating to draw a map and have it evolve over time.
Hmm. What are other people doing that you're really stoked on? Whose work are you like really excitedly following right now?
In which realm?
I want to say games, but now I'm realizing that could be a lot of different things.
That's not helpful.
That's not helpful at all. I don't know. Let's say RPGs, because I guess that's what my listeners are like into, and also what I am into. Yeah, RPG and LARP.
Okay. In RPGs, the project that I'm personally following with the most interest is William Nichols is working on an RPG. I think it's Solar, Wind, and Sail, if he hasn't changed the name again. Mm-hmm. Which is about, it's about people on a spaceship, but it's very much using economy as one of the primary mechanisms in the game, which is a really unique perspective that William's bringing to RPGs, which have traditionally had economies, but never been, but they've always been kind of ancillary, kind of. Something that you do that looks like it matters, but perfunctory.
Mm.
That's the longer of the two words that I was looking for to describe that. But but in his game, it's kind of I don't want to say it's all about the economy, because that makes it sound like nothing else matters and that it's all just spreadsheets, and that's not the situation. It's more about how the people are affected by what resources they have available, how that changes their motivations, and making hard decisions about what to do with those resources.
Hmm. You know something? I had so much fun LARPing with your mom and dad. It was really rad and cool, and they were great. 'Cause you basically like grew up playing RPGs, right? They're super into D&D.
Yeah. Yeah, I have vague memories of my parents playing Dungeons & Dragons. This would have been first edition when I was six, and I was there playing with a little plastic rust monster toy, because they found a bag of these little plastic D&D miniatures that they could distract me with, so that I wouldn't destroy their. Or put their, you know, sharp metal resin miniatures in my mouth. so they had a D&D group back in Flagstaff. And there were a few years. So after we moved, I don't think we played D&D for a while. But I eventually heard about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles RPG.
Oh, whoa.
And I was like, I'm going to get that. And I'm gonna play it. And that got me back into D&D. I found some friends who I was playing Rifts and TMNT and Dungeons, Dragons, and Champions. Oh, Champions with, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we were able to, we met a family friend, John, in the area. And he had some friends, and we played D&D with them, and villains and vigilantes and things like that. For a number of years, we don't have a regular game at the present, but we still get together at least a couple times a year, and I think we might try to do that a little more often now.
Mm-hmm.
to role play. Yes,
that's right. So you do like J-Con, right? You do a little like house con that's just like, hey, my friends, come over to my house and play some games. And
yeah.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that, because I wish that more people realize that a con can be that, and you can do that.
Yeah, there's very little stopping you if you can make a little bit of room in your house, or you know, find the friend of yours who can make the most room and is willing to. Mm-hmm. For the first several years, instead of J-Con being hosted at my house, my brother-in-law and sister hosted at their house because they had more space. Mm-hmm. Very generous of them, but yeah, it's you can basically feed 30 of your friends for the weekend for less than it costs to get just the hotel room at any con anywhere for the weekend, much less travel expenses or the food that you'd be eating there, and you can be eating better food, and you can be sleeping in your own bed and showering Yeah, hosting your own con is a real viable option.
I really dig that. How long have you been doing that? And what have you learned?
It's interesting. No one knows how long exactly I've been doing that. No one knows. About, I don't know, 10 years ago, I was like, how long have I been doing this? And I checked all my archives, and I checked with some friends who should have some good archives, and a friend who has an amazing memory, and just none of them could find that information.
Cool.
It's probably about 15 years now.
Wow, that's amazing. So what is your advice if people listen to this and they're like, what? A house con? It doesn't have to be in a hotel in order to be a con. What would your advice to them be?
So for the first many years, I was trying to split the costs very precisely. I was like, okay, who was here Friday night? Who was here Saturday morning? Who was here Saturday night?
Mm-hmm.
And based on what meals you were around for, and then dividing the total cost and making then like exceptions and all this stuff. After a long time, I'm just like, you know what? I'm going to cover this. And if you want to spot me a 20 to help offset that cost or whatever amount you feel like is appropriate, you do that. Because the cost to feed all those people is less than it is to get a hotel room at a real con. You know, not everyone can necessarily pay that up front, but anyone who can go to a con can, and then your friends can just, you know, pay you back as they will. Or maybe, you know, if you can't put that money forward, then just say, hey, it's a potluck every day. Every day, everybody brings one dish, and however many people come, that's going to be enough food. Yeah, you could do it for effectively nothing, or, you know, the cost of potluck.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I really dig that. Something I really dug was that I was really interested in the amount of effort that you put into your safety policy for the most recent JCon, which you wrote up yourself. Why was that kind of time investment and really like precision of language important to you when, you know, it's a small con and, you know, we're all friends here and blah, blah, blah. Like all the regular excuses that people have for not using safety mechanisms were just like so there.
Yeah. And this is the first time that I've made that as official as it was, as explicit as it was, for exactly the reason you point out, you know, when it's just people that I've invited, friends that I know, you know, that there's kind of the implicit, let's just be cool and it'll be fine. But, I want to invite more people. I want to invite people who don't know everyone else. And B, it really helps to say what I think is implicit, explicitly, so that everyone can know that. Because what I think is common sense isn't 100% what everyone else thinks is common sense. And, kind of one of the most important things about a safety policy is making it clear to people who often get missed by bad assumptions, making them know for sure that they won't be missed. You know, it's there's so many people who get who are made to feel invisible or who complain and are ignored because of these simple assumptions that they were being fine, they were being good, or that's not really an issue here. And those people aren't going to give your con a chance if you haven't made it crystal clear that they are welcome and that they are going to be protected. Yeah, and it was actually a really good exercise to go through and figure out all the language that I wanted and how I wanted to word it. Because, you know, it was all ideas that existed in some nebulous form. But as with writing rules or anything else, the act of finding the exact wording and putting it on paper really helps crystallize some of those concepts.
Right, yeah. So when you think about like the future of role-playing and of gaming communities, what's your hope? Where would you like us to be?
I would love to see gaming communities that have the same demographics as the world or the country or the county or, you know, wherever they are. I would love, essentially what that actually means is that everyone who would enjoy that activity, if they felt safe and welcome, feels safe and welcome.
Well, damn, that's so succinct, Jay. You're answering my question so precisely. And
I choked up a little bit there. Aw, Jay. That's okay. I barely got that last word out.
Aw.
Yeah. The only way that I can justify being in games as opposed to humanitarian care or politics or something where I can really make a difference, where I can really make the world a better place, is if I can use games to make the world a better place. One of the ways to do that is to make games that help teach players to be better. And another way to do that is to make sure that everyone has the opportunity to play games. And games are such a good community builder. They're such a good way to make friends and to understand people as humans, as you know, friends. I've talked about this before, but I love the ability to go into any game night and just sit down with people I don't know and play games. And we don't even have to introduce ourselves immediately. We can just start playing the game. And so this is something that, you know, if you have social anxiety or, you know, any other holdback, this is a really good way to get that introduction, to just have time with people. And very often it leads to at least familiarity, if not friendship. And it's also one of the most effective ways to learn who a person is. You could small talk someone in a bar for 2 hours all night long and not learn as much about their actual character as you could in a 15-minute game of Werewolf with them.
I feel like that's such a huge part of why I even like LARPing, is just that I want to, like, know people and be known. And I like doing that as fast as possible and a lot. Because it is, like, a really, really good way to do that.
Yes, and LARPing, so there are definitely, I still play tabletop RPGs, but many of the RPGs that I used to play, I'm now sitting at the table thinking, why are we sitting around saying, my character says this, rather than standing around and saying that thing in character? Because LARP is so effective a tool. Not just escaping and being somebody else, but at adopting a new perspective and gaining new understanding by looking through a character's eyes. It's incredible to me how effective that tool is in LARPing. And that's why I'm such a strong proponent of the experience. There's just no 2 hours, 4 hours of LARP, there's just no faster way to come to understand another person, another culture, another way of being, than to just pretend to be that for 2 hours with other people in the same shared reality.
Connection and understanding, and I get so, like, when I think about this stuff, I get all idealistic and shit. Well, this has been a very, very lovely chat. If my listeners want to keep up with you and find out what you're doing, and hear your very complicated and confusing thoughts on magic cards, where should they go and do that?
I've got a fan magic design space at Goblin Artisans. If you Google search Goblin Artisans, or go to goblinartisans.blogspot.com, or I think even goblinartisans.com, you can see quite a few custom designs that I've got a whole group of people that I work with there. And you can also follow @WizardsFamiliar on Twitter.
Go to there. Call to action. Okay, last question. When is everyone in the world going to get to play your Cthulhu Twister game? Because it's really, really, really fun, and I need more people to get to play it.
So we're working on the contract now. I don't yet know enough to say whether I should name the publisher or not, but there is a not insignificant hobby games publisher who wants to give me a contract for Twisted. Given the nature of the game, it will probably be more than a year before it starts showing anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, people will be able to form 2-player teams of cultists and ancient ones and try to twist over Arkham to summon themselves and take over the mortal plane.
And fall down.
And fall down.
Yeah. It's very fun and good. I like it. That's one of my favorite kinds of games, is just the kinds that put narratives on top of like existing mechanics, because mechanics alone without story are really boring to me.
Yeah, and I also very much wanted to add a little bit of choice and strategy to the old time-tested game.
Yeah, it's a little more complex than just the spinner. Okay, cool. That's all. Thank you so much for coming on, Jay.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex. It is always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Yay.
Well, thanks to Jay for joining us, and as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you want to get in touch, you can email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me, @backstorycast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows at oneshotpodcast.com, including One Shot itself. One Shot is an actual play podcast where host James D'Amato leads a rotating cast of improvisers, game designers, and other notable nerds through a variety of role-playing games. Every month, One Shot plays a new game with a new cast of players, and it's bound to be entertaining. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. Talk to you later, heroes!